Kirk, before we turn to Iowa's testimony, my guess is that you probably watched some of the news coverage on the flood, as they say, of biblical proportions in South Carolina.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you happen to catch any of the antics of the South Carolinians as they drove their cars into the floodwaters?
It's a dangerous thing to do. I mean, if you've ever done that, your car stalls out, and then what are you going to do?
If you're really careful depending on the car, if you're in a truck, yeah. You can probably go through, if you could measure it, 1 foot of water.
Mm-hmm.
Anything more than a foot of water, your car is going to stall out. And the force applied to your car is going to whisk you whichever way the water's going. I mean, the stupidity of doing that. And to leave your car in a low-lying area and not be smart enough to say, maybe I need to drive my car someplace. And then they would interview these people, and the other thing that just struck me is not only the lack of intelligence. In fact, this morning they had the mayor of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've ever heard a mayor of that's a fairly large city, as inarticulate as this man was. And you wonder, if the majority of people voted for him, did they ever listen to him talk?
He might own a lot of the downtown. So.
Oh, and then you look at the obesity of people. And, you think about the fact that we're providing food stamps to 75 million Americans. And those that are living in the most impoverished situations are obese.
Yeah. That's always been disturbing on food choices of poor people. It's unfortunate that they don't teach them some health.
I think it's just this, if you don't take responsibility, and you're given something that you have not earned, you have no respect for it.
No.
Food is something you do have to have a sense of understanding and respect. You always spend a lot of time talking about food. It's something you ought to be thoughtful of. You ought to think about. You ought to engage in all things thoughtfully and responsibly. In fact, it was said, you can eat anything you want to, so long as you're thoughtful about it.
Mm-hmm. Why, though, would you do that to your buddy? At some point, you know you should be pushing away from the table, or you should be...
Yeah, but that's, again, people unwilling to take personal responsibility, to be accountable. During the presentation of all this stuff that's happening that's so bad there in the Carolinas, they had a diabetes drug commercial. And 80% of the people they showed were 50, 60, 70, 80 pounds overweight.
Well, that's the target group, yeah.
But where's your responsibility? Why take the pill to fix your diabetes instead of losing the weight to cause the diabetes?
The overall theme. May I ask a question?
Sure.
The overall theme in the past hour, I kept thinking to myself, if you were, because I don't understand how stupid we become. I really, really don't, no matter what theory is thrown out. But if you could own or control Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Libya, and Somalia, what would you have?
What would you have? Why would you want to do it?
Oh, yeah, I would say, well, why would you want to is my second question.
Yeah. Afghanistan, what are you going to gain if you control Afghanistan? If that was your goal, if your goal wasn't to control it, your goal was just to break it, well, shame on you. If your goal was to play military to see how well your military performed, shame on you. But if your goal was to control it, why?
For what purpose? I mean,
Somalia, or Egypt, or Libya. I mean, there are some places.
You might want the Suez Canal, Saudi Arabia, you might want the oil. But beyond that, why are you there? I mean, I'm trying to find any motive that would make you some rational sense on why you would want those countries. Absolutely no reason.
If you wanted the Suez Canal, you don't have to conquer Egypt.
No, you just conquer the Suez Canal.
Right.
Apart
from the United States, Egypt doesn't have a military. No, I'm with you. In fact, even Iraq, yes, it has lots of oil. but the liability of those people, poisoned as they are by the terrorist religion of Islam, the price you'd have to pay to keep them under control so that you could benefit from the oil would exceed the value of the oil.
Yeah. I mean, and we're not energy deficient.
No.
Russia's not. China's got coal. We've got coal. We've got oil. We've got natural gas. Russia has plenty.
Right.
So
why are we there? Why are we there?
Why didn't anybody ask that question?
Why when Putin says, don't you know what you have done? And there's not a single politician, not a single journalist, not a single person in the media that says, look what we've done. Look what we've done. Look what what we've caused with our interventionism in Somalia, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, in Turkey, in Egypt, in Libya, in Syria. Look what we've done.
Well, there's no possible chance that a nuclear war can be averted at some point.
No, none.
Now,
and particularly now in Libya, I mean, excuse me, in Syria, where you've got the Russians not only flying aircraft and doing bombings,
have ships there.
But they've got ships there in the harbor, and they've got troops there. It's only a matter of time before the Russians kill Americans or the Americans kill Russians. And, you know, the way that America works, Americans will not think through. It's like the sinking of the Lusitania. They will not think through why that ship was there and why that ship should not have been there. And will instead, with their unthinking patriotism, say, make them pay. It'll be like the sinking of the Maine. It'll be thoughtless, knee-jerk patriotism, and Americans uniformly will want to go off and kick some Russian butt. That's what's going to happen.
We can't beat the Russians. They have nuclear weapons.
No, we can't.
Is that all those years?
No, you want to go to war against the Russians or the Chinese, and soon the Iranians, and it's lose-lose. So you have the most powerful military in the world. What good is it going to do you? What chance do you have that everyone is just going to play the way you want them to play? You know, when the Islamic State, when Al-Qaeda before them, when fundamentalist Muslims realized that they had no chance of ever prevailing in a conventional war where they went mano a mano with any military in the world, they simply used Muhammad's tactic of terrorism, found the soft targets, went after those who were defenseless. Our military does nothing and can do nothing to protect us from that.
Well, it's like your local police force. They can't protect you. They come in and take notes after something has happened.
But that's not the case with China, that the United States has positioned itself against. That's not the case with Russia.
No. They can absolutely do that.
And since last time I checked, most things that are sold in America are made in China. What do we think? How could we prevail by making an enemy of our supplier? You know, it's like that girl at UCLA, the Pi Phi, that was hooked on methamphetamines and other really serious mind-altering drugs. And she was caught in possession of the drugs, and so our Justice Department was talking about prosecutors cutting her a deal that if she fingered her suppliers, that they would go easy on her sentence for being a druggie. And so her suppliers got word of that, and they murdered her and then burned her apartment down. And you say, you know, if you finger those who are supplying you, there's going to be a consequence. No one thought this through.
You don't seem to think anything through.
No, we don't. Here with Putin and with Netanyahu and with Rouhani of Iran and with the Xi of China, every one of them put right in front, served up a platter full of mea culpa. saying that the United States has consistently made a mess of things, made bad situations worse now for 7 decades, and that nothing has worked out the way that America intended. It's time to try something new. And you know what the first step of new would be?
To be
accountable, to admit that you're wrong. And the second step of new would be to stop doing what you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know Russia wants to try something new. That's way down the list. You know, when you first came to know that Yahweh's testimony was wholly different than the religion that you had been part of, Christianity, was the first reaction to try something new, I think I'll become a Muslim?
No, the first reaction just stop what you were doing.
Right.
Start studying.
Right. I think actually the first is beyond that. And in fact, you've told me what your first reaction was, and it's the appropriate reaction, the initial appropriate reaction is to be accountable, is to say, you know, I was duped.
Boy.
What I believed, what I acted upon was wrong. Isn't that the first reaction, what it needs to be if you're going to make any progress?
Well, you've got to acknowledge
you've been wrong. I mean, that's what I did. I've been had. Man, I was up to my eyeballs in Christianity and up to my eyeballs in conservative Republican politics and pro-military patriotism. And so the first thing I had to do with each of these was just to admit that I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second is to stop supporting them.
Right.
You know, the third is to expose and condemn them so that other people might see the light, might be liberated from the spell of these things. And only then are you in a position, once you have admitted you're wrong, you've disassociated from them, you've tried to help others be liberated from their indoctrination, only then are you in a position to say, well, maybe there is an answer. Well, you know what the answer is not. It's not religion. It's not politics. It's not militarism. It's not patriotism. Those are not the answers. But I don't think you can do any justice to the truth until you first change your perspective so that it's no longer cluttered by the lie.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Otherwise, you're likely to go from one mistake to another, you know, to go from Christianity to Islam, to go from Islam to Christianity.
Yeah. That's what I call a smorgasbord, where you just pick, well, let's go pick something else.
Yeah, let's go pick something else. Yes, it's a world now where the vast preponderance of people can't think. You know, when Netanyahu made the statement about Iran, and his statement's irrefutable, that Iran has threatened to destroy Israel, kill every last Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the world capitulated on a nuclear deal that will give them the capability of doing that. And he says there's been nothing but silence. And for 44 seconds, there wasn't a single person that acknowledged their support vocally, with a clap, with a shout, with anything. He could have gone 4 times 44 seconds. There is no one willing to stand up. Reminds me of that comment that we find Yahweh making over and over again in Yeshayahu, Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to find someone.
Nobody.
I wanted to find someone, but there was no one.
Nobody to work with.
Netanyahu took the gamble that there would be no one. Maybe it wasn't a gamble at all. There would be no one, not a single friend in the United Nations, not a single moral or rational person. He was right.
So when it comes to nuclear war, which it will,
mm-hmm.
What are you looking at, 2027, 2028, the Magog War?
Well, I think that that it's going to play out such that based on what Yahweh said in Yeshayah 17 and what he said in Ezekiel, is that we're going, and based upon just the facts that we're witnessing around us, we're going to see absolutely no change in the civil war that's taking place in Syria. That the Sunni-Shia civil war is going to continue to be the focus of the world and the catalyst for the next world war, and it will continue to be deadly. It will continue to send Muslims throughout Europe and the United States. It's going to fundamentally change the world, and negatively. And that fight is going to continue until the city-state of Damascus is in ruins.
All right.
And when it's in ruins, Russia and the United States will be at each other's throats. And the government of Syria will fall. There will be no Syria, just as there is no Iraq.
Right.
And that as a result of that, the Muslims, the Sunni Muslims who ultimately prevailed, are going to be very, very full of themselves. And somewhere between now and then, I think it is likely that they will invade Jordan and prevail. I think that they're going to invade Saudi Arabia and over a wide swath of territory prevail.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think there'll be skirmishes in Lebanon, but that ultimately there'll be no nuclear war, Kirk, until the second phase of this Magog war. I think using American-supplied conventional weapons, the Sunnis, and we know they'll be American because America's arming the Sunnis,
well, yeah,
while the Russians and the Chinese are arming the Shias, and the Shias are going to lose. Damascus falls. Syria falls.
Mm-hmm.
So God's already told us who wins this war.
It's
the Sunnis, not the Shia. And they were going to use American conventional weapons to invade Israel. And nations, Islamic nations are going to join them. And Israel's going to be blamed for the fall of everything. And in the midst of that, in the final throes of death of Iran and Shiite Islam, I wouldn't be surprised if it's Iran that is the nation that touches off this this war. But Russia and the United States, China, and I don't know for certain China, but certainly Russia and the United States and Europe are going to retaliate.
China is when you have the second phase of that war, the World War IV, if you like, that's so predominant from Asia that I don't think Asia is going to be taken out with tons and tons of nuclear.
Yeah, you know, keep in mind that it really says is that they're going to cross the Euphrates.
That's true. Could be.
That's really all it says, that they're going to cross the Euphrates.
True.
And so, you know, that could be the residue of what's left of, since it'll be Sunni Islam that's already taken over Syria and Damascus and Jordan, and most of Iraq, that since it'll be Sunni Islam that will attack with conventional weapons against Israel, it could well be that Iran, which would have to cross the Euphrates, and with Russia and China collectively, could be the catalyst coming against Israel and the second phase of that war, the nuclear phase of that war. But you know, here we are. We're on the precipice of World War III, and we're actually seeing the initial battles of World War III. And the world is listening to the deafening words of Putin, of Xi of China, of Rouhani of Iran, and of Netanyahu, and we can't process them. We're too celebratory in our Pope celebration, I guess, to be able to even hear what was said. You know, Putin's question, don't you realize what you've done? How could America not realize what it's done? How could John McCain get up in the morning and the Obaminator get up in the morning and not accept responsibility for what they have done in Libya and Syria? Whose words are theirs?
Well, I remember back when Ford wiped out the Shah of Iran. I mean, they just decided not to support him anymore, and that opened up that door.
Well, that was really more Jimmy Carter than Gerald Ford, but yes.
Yeah, but I mean, it goes way back to even then. They had already separated as far as, you know, they got rid of one party, put another one in power, and they
Oh yeah, we're, you know, one of the most revealing books is the history of the CIA and America's manipulation of the world, and how the CIA became stunningly Machiavellian. I mean, it was comprised initially of Nazis, so I guess we shouldn't be surprised. But how we thought that the world was ours to manipulate any way that we wanted. It didn't matter who we killed, who we empowered, what riots we started, but that's what we did. And it's one of the reasons the world doesn't respect us. And then that cancer that is the CIA is climaxed with admissions that it, with presidential authority, committed acts of torture. We've become what we despised, and we don't seem to care.
That's the part I don't get.
You know, there's no one answering Putin's question. Don't you realize what you've done? No one wants to realize what we've done with the Eric Snowden revelations of the NSA turning Americans into its enemies. No one wants to realize what America did on a pile of lies in Afghanistan, or a pile of lies in Iraq, or a pile of lies in Syria, a pile of lies in Libya, a pile of lies in Vietnam. You know, we have this illusion that we're manifest destiny, we're one nation under God, that God bless America, and you look how we treated the native peoples and stole their lands.
I had a conversation last night with someone, and we were talking about Buffalo Bill Cody, and I said, well, you know why he got what he's famous for, and they didn't really know, and I said, well, the key word is buffalo.
Yeah, buffalo.
Oh,
slaughter.
Yeah, wiped out the buffalo.
Just for fun.
Yeah, and I said, well, why do you think all those people wiped out the buffalo? And they said, I defeat the army? I said, it's millions of them. Millions and millions and millions of them. They did it to wipe out the Indians, all the food,
right,
all the clothing. And
right,
they just kind of look at you like, oh, wow.
Who were the savages?
Yeah.
Yeah, who were the savages? You know, this Pope says that a man who was part of the savages that led to the annihilation of 95% of the native populations in the Americas is a saint. You know, Sierra, what in the world's wrong with us? And no one objects? Lost our mind. Politicians, military officers, intelligence organizations, religious leaders have certainly made a mess of this world. It's not surprising, then, that Yahweh's idea of paradise is devoid of them. We only have two depictions, one tangible, the other strictly symbolic, of what Yahweh views paradise to be like, Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
What's the tangible example of paradise?
Well, Adam and Eve lived there.
Yeah.
Eden, or Eden?
Yeah, Eden.
Garden.
Yeah, gone, Eden. The protected enclosure, gone, of Eden, great joy. So there, if Yahweh was fond of militaries, would there have been armies?
Well, you would think if that was his thing, he would have it.
Did he march armies in front of Adam?
No, he had nothing. Nothing is needed.
If Yahweh was a Democrat, in the sense of he thought that democracy was the great political thing to ascribe to, do you think that there would have been a discussion between Adam and Chawa and Yahweh on, let's vote on that?
Hmm. If that was the truth, which it ain't, yeah.
How about the human institution of governance? Does Yahweh ever speak of human governance in the garden?
No, not at all.
No. Matter of fact, the first time that Yahweh actually speaks of human governance, it's in his discussion with the children of Israel about the stupidity of choosing a king.
Right. We cover that in great detail with Saul.
Yeah.
Or Sheol.
Yeah. Okay. Was there a police force in Eden to protect the people, to serve and protect?
No.
No. Hmm. There were... What about certainly, you know, God's religious, right? There would have, there was a temple. They all went to church, right? Since the church is what Christians say is the thing that God has at once, I am certain then, rather than a tree of life, there would have been a church in Eden.
And a domo in there somewhere, huh? No domo.
How about a pope?
No.
No church, no pope.
No church, no pope, no priest.
Huh. Okay, so, well, then there must have been bowing down in prayer.
You got to have words for it, and there's not even words that would translate to that.
Huh. So none of that, huh?
No words, no prayer.
Huh. Were Adam and Chawa enslaved by Yahweh?
Seemed to be pretty free to me.
Were they given the freedom to choose to rebel against Yahweh?
Absolutely, they were.
And so they couldn't have been slaves, could they?
They were even given a vehicle to do it to participate in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Yahweh's idea of perfection has only one individual bowing down on his knees. Well, he's not bowing down, but one individual that is Barak on his knees.
No.
And is that Adam or
no.
Chawa?
No, afraid not. Yahweh.
So it's God. Yeah. So in Eden, God's idea of perfection, God gets on his knees, not man.
He descends to us.
So why do we think, since God's idea of perfection was for him to get down on his knees out of love to lift Adam up, why would we think that God's idea of perfection is us getting down on our knees to lift him up?
Well, that's the man-made construct of what should be done for man.
Yeah, it's the opposite of what God demonstrated.
I didn't have any part of that.
Yeah, God demonstrated what he wanted. And you think that God had some influence in Eden? You think God could have created Eden any way he wanted?
He could have made it any way he wanted. He could have made everybody crawling on their knees all day.
So why do you think Yahweh got on his knees, diminished himself to engage with Adam in Eden, rather than had Adam get on his knees trying to praise God?
Well, it was for his benefit. He wanted a family, so he created one and he joined the family.
Yeah.
Basically, he walked with us, he talked with us.
Yeah, but think about that. There's not a single statement in the Garden of Eden where Adam says, "Oh, God, you are so wonderful. I lift up your name in praise. I thank you for all of the wonderful things that you have done for me. Oh, God, let me get down on my knees and worship you."
There's no record of anything like that, no.
Not a hint of it. So obviously that's not God's idea of paradise, is it?
Yeah, even King James didn't get any of that in there.
Wow. And you'd think since it's the second story in a book that Christians lug around, even in their King James, that some of that might open their eyes and say, wait a minute, this is what God thinks is ideal, and there's not a prayer, there's no bowing down except him bowing down to on his knees to lift us up, that everything about paradise is the antithesis of my country and my religion. You'd think some of that would resonate. You would think, since the fourth story, the first story is creation, second story is about Adam and Chawa in the Garden of Eden, the third story is about the flood, and the fourth story is about Abraham. You would think, since the fourth story starts with walk away from your country, that would resonate with some people.
Mm-hmm.
And in the previous statement, he said that Abram was in Babel, and they're carrying a book named the Bible.
Babel.
Wow. Worshipping a Lord when Babel means with the Lord. Wow.
I don't expect everyone to get it, but right. I would expect enough so-called students of the word who became preachers to have gotten it and would have said it to them, and then that would have opened their eyes.
Yeah, none of this is hidden. Let's go to the third story.
Okay.
In the third story, Christians will tell you salvation is free. It's a gift of God, or that the church holds the keys to salvation.
One or the other.
Was Noah saved as a free gift?
No, he had to build his own ark to get out of there.
And the ark that he built, did he build it to his own specifications?
No, he would have drowned.
So what he did, he had to listen to what Yahweh said and acted upon his instructions. Otherwise, he would have drowned.
And he had to trust him.
Right. He had to do exactly what Yahweh encourages us to do to participate in the covenant. There was no free gift in his salvation. Do you think Yahweh told that story to contradict his story?
Hardly.
So when Yahweh issues the invitations to meet, because the next story talks about the things that took place to cause the Israelites to be enslaved in Egypt, and then with the ultimate crescendo of that story is Yahweh leading his children away from religious and political oppression and military oppression.
Okay.
Why is it that the Christian doesn't get that the Exodus was leading Yahweh's children away from religious, political, and military oppression and economic oppression, and that yet they're all blending their economic scheme, their military, their patriotism, and their religion as if they were godly and one?
How God could... How you could think that God produced American Romanism, which I call it now.
Yeah.
We have for a long time.
Right, yeah.
That if you can think that's what God had in mind and God does that, then you're sadly mistaken.
Yep. Religiously, the incarnation of Rome is the Roman Catholic Church and Christianity. But politically and militarily, and first and foremost, that Rome was a political and military power. The political and military incarnation of Rome is the United States.
And we took over the British Empire, which is very much that as well. I mean, even at the height of the British Empire, their art, their...
Right. We don't hide it. What was the national symbol of Rome?
Eagle.
The eagle. What's the national symbol of America?
Eagle.
What was the governing body of Rome called?
The Senate.
What's the governing body of the United States called?
The Senate.
We don't even make an attempt to hide it, do we?
No, we build our statues, our buildings, they're all...
Our national temples and shrines, they're all Roman. Yeah, it's...
Our religion is Roman. It's the dominant religion of America is Catholicism.
Right. Roman. And Yahweh says it's the ultimate beast. He says it's the beast that treads upon the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
What Putin just acknowledged, he says, you don't even recognize what you've done. Boy, I tell you what, when you've got a thug, and Putin's a bully and a thug, there's no question that Putin's not a nice guy. But when Putin asked that question to the United Nations and no one in America gets it, it proves that we've lost the ability to be circumcised, to be able to look in the mirror and know who we have become, what we are and what we're not. But, it's interesting, Kirk, that Yahweh's idea is the opposite. Rather than using blunt force and trying to impose your will, Yahweh says, rejoice and be glad. Be happy. In the presence of Yahweh for 7 days, celebrate it, as he's talking about Sukkah, as a festival feast in association with Yahweh for 7 days during the year. 7 days. Then he says, it is a clearly communicated prescription, an engraved instruction that cuts you into the relationship, a tukkah, eternally. And all of your homes and generations, no matter where you live or when you live, celebrate it in the seventh month. That guy that called the program on Friday that I put on hold because twice he said when we were talking about Sukkah and that it was the on the 15th day of the seventh month. And, we used the word for month, which Kodesh, which I defined as the based on Kadesh, is the renewing light on the moon's surface designating the beginning of a month and this being the seventh month. And he says, no, it doesn't say that. You know, he sent me a very hateful email. And in the email, he then quoted a definition of Kodesh.
Mm-hmm.
Month. Based on Kodesh of renewal, a time of renewal. And so when we quoted it accurately, he affirmed that we quoted it accurately, but we were wrong because we quoted it accurately. But you know where he went from there, Kirk?
Well, I read a little email and then I erased it because he was quoting like apocryphal books and things.
Yeah, yeah. His basis for this the entire presentation here of Sukkah, as well as each of the seven invitations to meet with Yahweh, comes from the Torah. And rather than quoting the Torah, no, he quoted Jubilees and Enoch.
Mm-hmm.
As the basis of what he said. And why would anybody choose to believe that Yahweh inspired these two books that are clearly frauds?
Mm-hmm.
There's no even trace of divine inspiration. Not a single accurate prophecy, no consistency. The reason they choose them, of course, is because the testimony is completely different than what you read in the other books.
Well, it's kind of like Paul, isn't it?
Kind of like Paul. You know, it's kind of like the rabbis as well, which Paul, of course, was a rabbi, which is that, you know, Yahweh says that he provided his Torah and that his Torah is complete and lacking nothing, and his Torah is easy to understand for those who are open-minded. Don't add anything to it. Don't take anything away from it. The rabbinical view is, well, God didn't explain himself very well, so you can't understand his Torah without our interpretations, and he didn't provide you enough information to obey his instructions, so we need to provide more holy writ. And so that's the basis of the Talmud. It's the basis of Jubilees and Enoch. You know, the argument is that God did not describe his calendar adequately in the Torah. Therefore, if you want to obey God's calendar, you've got to read these apocryphal books, Jubilee and Enoch.
I looked up 2324 from lexicons in the Hebrew, and it says exactly what it says. What you said it says. You did it perfectly. And it's not complicated. I mean, these words are very simple. I've looked them up hundreds of times at this point.
Yeah, there are very few words. Yeah, there are very few words as easy to translate as Kodesh.
Yeah.
And really, when it comes to Hebrew words, there are very few words as easy to translate as Hebrew. It's the Hebrew word for month, and it is literally means renewed moon is the literal translation of it. And by telling you that a month begins with a renewal of the light on the moon's surface, and then speaking of a calendar year and telling you what transpires during the first month, which is barley is Abib and the flax is in flower, God has given you every bit of information you need to establish his calendar.
Sure.
But they say, no, the God was in according to the Enochers, and by the way, I've got nothing against Hanak, the person mistranslated Enoch. But Hanak, the real Enoch, did not write the book that's falsely attributed to him. But the Enochers will tell you, no, you need Enoch and Jubilees to establish a calendar, which is to say that God is a
He's a hack
at communication. He's not able to establish a calendar.
Well, at some point I just went over it and over it, and I said, "Gosh, you can't screw this up." I mean, this is
what
nobody disagrees with these.
Yeah, and so here he's got celebrate your festival feast for 7 days during the year. And he's made it very clear that this is the seventh month of the year, and so he's got a solar lunar calendar, the calendar of the world at that point of view. Then he said,
"What else could you have done at that time? I mean, what else could you have done at that time?"
In fact, in this sentence, he says, "In the seventh Kodesh month." So it's a celebrate it each year. It is for 7 days during the year, celebrated during the seventh month. Mm-hmm. Oh, my. And you're saying that God did not describe what the seventh month was until the book of Enoch, which appeared around 200 to 300 BCE, when this instruction is being given out between right around 1400 BCE, that it would take 1,000 years before God provided anybody with the means of actually doing what he was instructing? Doesn't sound like a very responsible father to me. Simple instructions. Go ahead, Kirk.
Well, no, I just take this stuff so serious, and I don't want to make a mistake, and especially because I get a chance to chat with you and on the air, and other people hear it. I do my homework as best my little pea brain can do.
You want to be right, correct?
That's all we seek
is we recognize we're flawed instruments.
Sure.
And we are not perfect, and all we're seeking to do is to be right. We want to be correct in our presentation of the words that Yahweh chose.
And why people keep looking for searching something besides the Torah, which is the same thing that Christians do because they don't like the Torah, so they search for something besides the Torah. The Jews couldn't get rid of the Torah because it was right there in their temple, so they had to in the Ark there, so they had to rewrite it and have you study that and.
Right. The Talmud and the Mishnah, right?
These modern people, they keep looking for some secret book somewhere, and they gravitate to Jubilees and the Book of Jasher sometimes, and the Book of Enoch, and anything, and all these apocryphal books, just in order to find some secret thing. What are you looking for?
Yeah.
Just say, I don't want any part of God. Go do your thing.
Yes.
I mean, to me, it's why you bring it in here?
I mean, the Torah is obviously
foundational. Yeah.
The Torah is obviously foundational, and the Torah is Yahweh proved that He is God and that He authored His Torah, and that the Torah can be relied upon in the throughout that book. There is no question that when you read it and you translate it and you rely on it and you're enlightened by it, that you'll be right, and be right on the single most important thing in the universe: right with God.
And I always remind myself, Yahusha never quoted anything else.
No. He quoted the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Why would I be wasting my time doing all that other stuff?
I don't know. You know, this next line here that is really profound in my view. He has said, you should live in shelters, in tents, in a temporary, you should camp out for 7 days. All native-born Israelites shall dwell in the sheltered tents, should camp out, so that your households and your generations will know the physical symbolism of me having the children of Israel live in these covered shelters, camping out when I brought them out of the land of the crucible of Egypt. Again, this is the connections that people duped by political correctness or duped by the religion can't seem to make. Didn't he just equate Sukkah to the Exodus?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't he just equate Sukkah to the experience that he and the Israelites had when they camped out together? When his physical presence was with them?
Correct.
So if God's idea of Sukkah is a physical, tangible symbol of what he did during the Exodus, which is he freed his children from slavery, from oppression in the most religious, political, militaristic place on earth, and then camped out with them, ought we not see the entire Moed Mikre, these seven invitations to meet with God, exactly as Yahweh just defined them?
Sure.
Well, isn't that profound? That it's a journey away from religion and politics and militarism, from being enslaved to being free, and that the journey leads to camping out with God. That is not only the journey, but also the destination?
Mm-hmm.
and what's more important than that?
Well, I can't see anything more important than that. Everywhere he goes, he says, stand up, walk with me.
But But if God made it this obvious, where he's equating Sukkah to him camping out with his children, him providing their light, their nourishment, their clothing, their teaching via the Torah.
Education. With,
yeah, education and living in their presence. If that's what Yahweh is equating the seven steps that end with Sukkah to, and telling us this is all symbolic now of what I did on your behalf, leading you away from your country, from that country that enslaved you.
Mm-hmm. That military that tried to kill you.
Yeah. The military that tried to kill you. The religion that tried to oppress you. Tried to deceive you. And here you are now, camping out with me, living with me, enlightened by me, receiving my personal teaching. And you don't see it? How could you miss it?
Yeah,
maybe he said it was just for you, and we had a great time, but you know, I don't like that plan anymore. But no, what did he say? He says, this is for all time, for eternity, so that you would know that I am Yahweh, your God. And Moshe declared the word of Yahweh, specific appointed meeting times, to the children of Yisrael. Why don't we listen to it?